You link technical computing software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the chair of the House Energy Committee kicks off an inquiry into the great blackout of 2003, declaring, "I don't want to hear any spin, but is it possible to keep politics out of energy policy?"
The U.S. reverses policy and appeals to the U.N. to help keep the peace in Iraq.
And conflict resolution in the preschool classroom. Advice for parents and teachers on how to include everyone in the games.
And she ended up being half Pokemon, half unicorn, half fairy princess. And she had magic powers, and everyone was happy.
These stories, and is China taking the fall for falling employment numbers? Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. officials say the Bush administration is circulating proposed language for a new U.N. Security Council resolution on post-war Iraq. The U.S. is working to convince more countries to contribute troops and resources to stabilize Iraq. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Some Security Council members that opposed the war that ousted the Saddam Hussein government in Iraq say they will not contribute troops to support a U.S.-led occupation. But some countries say they would be willing to help if the stabilization force had a clear U.N. mandate. The Bush administration has decided to seek such a mandate in order to ease the growing financial and military burden of the occupation on the United States. A State Department official says a draft of the new resolution would authorize an international security force for Iraq under a U.S. command. The official says the resolution would enhance U.N. authority in Iraq, building upon two previous Security Council resolutions. All 15 Security Council members are expected to have seen the draft by the end of the day. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
The Speaker of the Palestinian Parliament won't hold a vote of confidence in Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. He'd probably lose. There's a dispute between Abbas and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat over who controls Palestinian security forces. Palestinian lawmakers don't want to get in the middle of it, and most of them apparently want Abbas and Arafat to work out their differences rather than push Abbas out of office. A boat capsized in a river in eastern India. Police believe at least 25 people may have drowned. Martha Ann Overland reports from New Delhi.
Authorities say the boat was heavily overloaded when it sank midstream about 150 miles northeast of Patna, the capital of the state of Bihar. Officials say strong currents caused by recent monsoon rains made it difficult for people to swim to safety and has hampered rescue efforts. Large parts of eastern India are under a flood alert. In the coastal state of Orissa, hundreds of thousands of villagers had to be rescued after rising waters left them marooned. Much of the flooding has been caused because officials have been forced to release water from dams upriver to prevent them from bursting. For NPR News, I'm Martha Ann Overland in New Delhi.
A former minister who murdered a doctor that performed abortions is scheduled to be executed today. Paul Hill is on death row in Florida. He's refused to appeal his death sentence and says he expects a great reward in heaven for his act. Residents of Bermuda are watching the progress of Hurricane Fabian. It's a Category 4 storm about 700 miles south of Bermuda. Forecasters say they expect Fabian will have a significant impact on Bermuda in the next 2 to 3 days. Top winds are measured at 135 miles per hour. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 22 points at 95.45. The Nasdaq is up 14 at 85.55. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham tells lawmakers his department will find out what caused the massive East Coast blackout. He won't try to guess what triggered it, but he says he and his Canadian counterparts will follow the facts wherever they lead. Abraham says his investigation will also recommend steps to prevent a second blackout. Congress is looking at rules that would force utilities to have reliable means of transmitting power. There's a voluntary system currently in place. The Commerce Department says construction spending rose in July to its highest level in 6 months, another sign of a rebounding U.S. economy. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
The July increase in construction spending was 0.2%. That was smaller than many economists had been predicting. Still, it was the biggest gain since January. The seasonally adjusted annual rate was nearly $880 billion, with increases in spending on residential construction as well as utilities and communications. There were declines in spending on hotels, motels, and commercial office buildings. Perhaps more positive, a revised number on June's construction spending. It registered a gain of 0.7%, up from the government's previous estimate of 0.3%. Federal Reserve policymakers meet again in 2 weeks to discuss interest rates. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
A California judge has ordered a grocery store chain to pay $1.8 million in a pricing case. The second biggest grocery store chain in the country, Albertsons, overcharged some California customers using a scanner system. Albertsons says most of the errors occurred after it bought out a rival, Lucky's, 5 years ago. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation, for support of the Endowment Fund for NPR West, NPR's new production center in Los Angeles.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
I told you so. That's what Louisiana Congressman Billy Tozan said this morning as he kicked off the first congressional hearing into the largest power outage in U.S. history. Tozan warned 2 years ago that the nation was vulnerable to blackouts like the one that paralyzed New York, part of the Midwest, and Canada last month. And as chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, he sketched the goal of the hearings.
I realize there have been a lot of attempts to politically spin this event, create partisan arguments about who may or may not be responsible for it here or there or anywhere else. I hope we avoid that today. I'm not terribly interested in that. I hope you aren't either. I think the American public wants us to examine what happened, why, and what we can do to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, what's long spun out of control, some say, are previous congressional efforts to hammer out an energy policy. And energy bills been repeatedly bogged down by disagreements over oil drilling in Alaska and deregulation and whether to build new nuclear power plants. Well, here for some perspective on all this is Gail Chadwick. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us from Capitol Hill. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you.
Well, Gail, well, opening statements so far, but what should we expect from these 2 days of hearings? Michigan power companies already blaming Ohio power companies for the blackout, finger-pointing. Will we get something more constructive?
I think it's going to be a very interesting couple of days, but it's good to know what to listen for. The first level you've heard in the opening statements already is the fight over what's going to happen to the energy bill. Republicans almost uniformly are saying the blackout is a good reason to push the entire bill right now. ANWR, some $19 billion in subsidies for new production. Democrats are saying, no, the blackout is a good reason to take out only those provisions which we all agree on or come close to agree on how to make electricity transmission more reliable. Focus on that, pass it as a separate bill, and don't bog it down with all these other things.
Yeah, so this energy bill, now the House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Billy Tozan apparently promised President Bush an energy bill by late September. He made that promise last night. Think that's going to happen?
Well, I think it's very unlikely at this point. If the hearings to date are any indication, you have Republicans already adding trial lawyers as being part of the problem, and Democrats saying the fault is really with energy companies for gouging prices, with oil and gas companies, with OPEC. With people are using the public outrage over the blackouts to try to link it to every pet project they've ever had.
Well, that doesn't sound very promising. Now, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham testifies. Now, he says a joint U.S.-Canadian task force on the blackout also won't rush to any conclusions. So just very briefly, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, I guess we shouldn't expect too much of these 2 days of hearings.
Well, I think you're going to learn a lot. You're going to learn a lot about the fights within the industry. For example, surprising to me this morning is how important it is for many of the new companies. They want a federal role, contrary to what you usually expect. And I think the interesting debate is going to be whether the White House is going to back off a pledge it apparently has made to Southeastern senators to not give the federal authority more of a role in actually determining what happens with the transmission grid. Will the federal role be bigger or won't it? That's the question that's going to come out of the next 2 days.
Gail Chadwick, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
The Bush administration has decided to ask the UN to take a greater role in post-war Iraq, to craft a multinational force under U.S. command. The move to work with the UN comes as a Congressional Budget Office report warns that the Army lacks sufficient active duty forces to maintain its current staffing level beyond next spring. One U.S. official says the White House now envisions a new peacekeeping operation that will look like the kind that is familiar to us. Well, Canadian retired Major General Louis McKenzie on the line from Toronto knows what that will look like. He was the commander of U.N. troops in Sarajevo in 1992. And, Major General, your first reaction to today's news?
Well, certainly coercing the Security Council should be possible by the U.S. I know France will play its French game, but ultimately I think they'll get a resolution. The problem is always finding the resources. And these days there's not a lot of folks lining up to do any peace operations within the U.N., except those countries that expect financial remuneration. So that's why right now Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nigeria at the head of the list of contributors to current UN missions because of the $1,100 US per soldier per month that are paid to the national coffers. So let's hope that other soldiers and other countries can be bought to lighten the burden for the U.S. and Iraq.
Well, you pointed out the objections from other countries. Both Germany and France have said that they're resistant to the idea of a U.S.-led peacekeeping force. Kofi Annan has reportedly assured the U.S. that there would have to be a unified command of any international participation and that that command would be the United States. Your thoughts?
Well, missions are like that, Robin. I think it's misunderstood. The military commander is never in command of a UN peace operation. There's what's known as an SRSG, a special representative of the Secretary General, which is a civilian diplomat. And he or she is the overall person responsible for the mission.
I'm wondering, too, if with American troops being killed in Iraq every other day, two National Guardsmen killed yesterday, with car bombings, the bombing of the UN headquarters, might some countries, you know, not even be willing to send troops despite the money?
Well, certainly within democratic countries, and I wish the UN was made up the majority of democratic countries. It's not. But in democratic countries, governments have to be very conscious of that fact when they're trying to sell the idea of deploying to Iraq to their population. However, there are a number of countries that are not democratic, and therefore they can make the hardball decision like that at the national leadership level. And once again, I can't overstress enough the financial remuneration that plays a major role in that decision.
Especially since they'll be paid in U.S. dollars.
Absolutely. And not only do you receive your nation receives $1,100 per soldier per month, you receive rental fees for all the equipment that you take to the mission area. And in addition, while your troops are there, they're fed and they're housed by the United Nations at UN expense, of which the United States pays 25% to 27% of the bill. So you're getting stuck with the bill one way or the other.
Mm. And, Major General, if I could ask you from your expertise just to give us 30 seconds of some of the challenges that lay ahead for a multinational peacekeeping force.
Well, getting it there and getting it organized so it can respond to the direction from the commander. I mean, it normally takes the UN 4 to 6 months to put a force together and get it over there, and I'm sure the United States doesn't want the UN to take that long, but nevertheless, that's a historical record. And once they get there, compatibility of equipment, language, there are tons of challenges that'll be facing the commander. However, they can be assigned areas, given them tasks, and told to get on with it. And that's the way that we've all discovered in the past to attack the problem. It won't be a slick military operation like the U.S. is used to, but they've experienced similar challenges in Kosovo and Bosnia.
Well, and as some would point out, it hasn't been, you know, all that slick in the past few months.
Major General Lewis McKenzie, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Retired Major General Lewis McKenzie is the author of Peacekeeper, The Road to Sarajevo.
When the federal budget is calculated by the Congressional Budget Office and Office of Management and Budget, Americans are being given only a very limited understanding of just how deeply in debt the country really is. That's the conclusion of a new study by the conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute. 2004's historic budget deficit of $480 billion, for example, may sound unnerving, but that number is still merely a fragment of a much larger long-term problem. The study concludes an additional $44 trillion is what the U.S. Treasury should have on hand right now to pay for future entitlements like Medicare and Social Security. Joining us on the line is Jagadish Gokhale, co-author of this study and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And Mr. Gokhale, what exactly is this $44 trillion you're talking about?
The $44 trillion is a characterization of the shortfall implicit in current spending and tax policies going through the infinite future. So we know that everything that government spends must be paid for out of receipts that the government gets. So if there is a shortfall, we need to characterize how big that shortfall is going forward. When we find the present value, that is, discount these future projected flows of outlays and receipts of the federal government, we come up with this $44 trillion number.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially a measure of the extent to which policies must change, either on the revenue side or on the receipt side.
Is there any sign that policies are going to change to reconcile these kind of numbers?
Unfortunately, no. In fact, policies being contemplated today are going in exactly the opposite direction, because we know that Congress is discussing the final compromise on a Medicare prescription drug benefit that will only add to its outlay commitments. And there is no discussion about how to pay for those additional outlays. Instead of actually looking for ways to shrink the financial shortfall, policies that are being contemplated today are going to increase the shortfall.
Now, you work at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. I wouldn't suspect that your way of dealing with this would be to raise taxes.
Well, essentially, much of the shortfall arises on account of Social Security and Medicare. So reforms of these entitlement programs is essentially the direction in which to go.
Reforms of entitlement programs,
right,
does that
right.
mean cutting them?
I don't think the solution will lie in exclusively reducing benefits or exclusively raising taxes. I think the thrust of our argument here is that our current budget accounting system is really limited in the sense that it does not allow us to make a fair comparison between alternative ways of financing our future health and retirement security needs.
How dangerous is all this?
It is extremely dangerous. We need to take care of these problems, and the place to start is to first rectify the federal government's budget accounting systems. Don't focus anymore on short-term measures such as debt or deficits going out 5 or 10 years, because the nature of the federal commitments extend much more than 5 or 10 years. And if we restrict our view of the federal budget to these traditional measures that essentially are the result of past policies and are not forward-looking and therefore limit our ability to distinguish or evaluate properly the alternative ways of reforming entitlement programs, then we have to get the fiscal house back in order. In order to do that, the place to start is to engage in proper fiscal accounting first.
Long-term, not just very long-term.
Long-term is the key.
Jagadish Gokhale, thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Jagadish Gokhale is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, what to say and do when the preschool set shuns one of its own.
And later in the program, what, if anything, does China have to do with the jobless rate in the U.S.?
There's more coming up here and now. Thank you.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Okay, think back to the first day of school. Way back to the very first day of school. Perhaps you can recall that butterfly feeling or some of the dreaded phrases. You can't play with us. I'm telling, and we don't like you. They don't like me. The worst thing a young preschooler can hear, and the title of a new book by Jane Catch, a preschool teacher at the Touchstone Community School in Grafton, Massachusetts, and author of the new book, They Don't Like Me, Lessons on Bullying and Teasing from a Preschool Classroom. And Jane joins us in the studio now to talk about it. Hi.
Hi.
Loved this book.
Thank you so much.
You know, when I first heard about it, I thought it was going to be a dry sort of something for educators, but it's for everyone because you tell these wonderful stories from observing your own students. And you share a story right in the beginning in which little ones repeat the phrase, you can't say you can't play. That's a good one. But it seems much harder to come up with a phrase to counter the we don't like you.
I think that is more complicated because children exclude each other and say mean things like we don't like you, no matter what the rule is.
Right.
But if they have the opportunity to talk about it, then they can have an opportunity to learn how to handle those unhappy situations that come up in life.
Let's talk about some of those. When just saying, you can't say you can't play, doesn't work. Zoe, for instance, is an imaginative and somewhat shy but incredibly creative young girl. And she was causing a lot of problems.
She was. She was both excluded because of her unpredictable behavior and excluding others because she wanted so much to make her life more controlled.
She might grow up someday to be a great, film director. But in the meantime, those same social skills don't work when actually, as you point out, this is in preschool, it's the first time a lot of kids are having to become a part of a social setting.
That's true. When they're three and even four, most children are happy if they have the toy they want. And as they start turning five, they become aware that there's a social group out there. Mm. And they not only see their own toy, but they see everybody else's toy and want to make sure that theirs is as good as everybody else's. Mm. And they want to make sure that they're a part of the social group that they want to be a part of.
I'm going to read an example. This is from the chapter titled, Are You Afraid of the Dark? And as in all the other stories, you've pretty much written word for word what the kids are saying to each other, which is so sweet, and then you try to resolve the problem. So here is the setting. They're playing, apparently, with Legos, and Russell is singing quietly to himself, Are you afraid of the dark? Gray magic is the best magic, he announces, because it can blend into anything. I know, Toby agrees. It's awesome. I love when that guy fights. I need another guy, he says, picking up a detached head. He pretends the head is talking. I need a body, he says, laughing. Are you afraid of the dark? Russell sings again. Sean turns to Noah, who's playing quietly at the other end of the table. Noah, can you tell me what you're afraid of? Sean says. Noah looks up quickly from the spaceship and says, The only thing I'm scared of is sharks. Ha ha, he's scared of sharks. I watch Noah's face go blank as he realizes he's made a big mistake. And here we have the setup, a bunch of little boys about to gang up on a littler boy. What do you do?
I've tried different things during the course of my kindergarten career. When I started teaching, I tended to want to ignore it because I thought if I called attention to the fact that Noah was being made fun of, that then everyone would see it and it would be worse for him.
Lord of the Flies.
Right. And then around the middle of my career, I started lecturing children. And I would say, now that sounds unkind. You really shouldn't do that. How would you feel if somebody did that to you? That was not really effective either. So during this period that I was writing this book, I would have all the children sit down and talk about the problem that happened and come up with solutions for what a person could do if that ever happened again, I would say.
Even in one story, having them reenact exactly what was happening to the moment where the crisis occurred.
We do that a lot, and the children sometimes forget that we're reenacting it and actually replay the original argument. But because we are acting it out and we have an audience of children who are eager to give suggestions, the children find out that there are a lot of different ways you can handle this situation.
But just they're fighting over the Legos and one young child is being tortured. And in that moment, how do you apply that?
I make the children stop playing and sit down and talk about it. And what we do is we collect ideas about what to do about it. And the children who are involved will choose one of the suggestions and try it out. If it doesn't work, we'll talk about it some more. But in that way, they get to hear other points of view, see that the situation looks different from somebody else's viewpoint, and see that one person isn't going to win and the other one isn't going to lose. It has to be a solution that works for everybody. So they learn that the solution to conflict is talking about it.
Just one last quick question. One of the most charming parts of the book is just, as I said, you just sit and listen and write down what they say. They say the wildest things.
They do. It always surprises me what their solutions are to problems. For instance, the day that the boys were playing a Pokemon game and Zoe wanted to be a unicorn in their Pokemon game. And I actually thought that they shouldn't have to incorporate unicorns into their Pokemon game. They had offered her a great part as Misty, a girl trainer, and I thought she should take it if she wanted to play Pokemon. But the children decided that it would be more fair if she was a Pokemon who was also a unicorn. And she ended up being half Pokemon, half unicorn, half fairy princess. And she had magic powers, and everyone was happy. That was really a symbol for the idea that even a child who seems difficult to get along with has so much to offer. And if the question is, how can a unicorn join a Pokemon game and make it even better? It's the same as saying, how can this child who doesn't yet know how to belong to a group come into our group and make our group even better?
And she did.
She did, yeah.
Well, again, it's a terrific book, not just for classrooms, but for homes.
Thank you, Robin.
Jane Catch, author of the new book, They Don't Like Me, Lessons on Bullying and Teasing from a Preschool Classroom.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is scheduled to sum up his first tumultuous 100 days in office.
Also, actress and UNICEF ambassador Jessica Lange has returned from a trip to the Congo. She'll tell us about the systematic use of rape in the war there. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, some say China's fixed currency system is costing Americans jobs. But one analyst tells us pressuring China won't bring jobs back to the American worker.
A company like Walmart, which last year bought about $12 billion worth of goods from China, is not going to all of a sudden start sourcing microwaves and laptops and socks from the United States. They're going to turn to another low-cost producer overseas.
Meanwhile, manufacturing activity in the U.S. is showing a slight rise, but even that's not expected to help the job market.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. The Bush administration is doing an about-face on Iraq and looking for more international involvement. Secretary of State Colin Powell is talking with his counterparts in allied nations about a UN resolution. Such a resolution would give other nations more of a role in post-war Iraq. America's ambassador to the United Nations is starting 2 days of discussions to outline the resolution. In Iraq today, the top U.S. commander transferred control over parts of the south-central zone of the country to an international force led by Poland. It's a step in Washington's campaign to bring more nations into the U.S. occupation. But in a sign of how violence has plagued U.S. plans, American Marines postponed the handover of the city of Najaf, where last week a car bomb killed between 85 and 125 people. President Bush met with a key ally today as part of the push for more international support in Iraq. Thelma Lebrecht reports from Washington.
The breakfast meeting at the White House with the Prime Minister of the Netherlands gives President Bush a chance to praise a U.S. ally with forces on the ground in Iraq. Also, Bush can urge other countries to help not only with troops, but with pledges of money to help rebuild Iraq. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the U.S. welcomes help from any nation.
It's an international issue that requires an international response.
Later today, Bush signs trade pacts with Chile and Singapore, deals the administration insists will boost the economy by increasing American exports. Thelma Lebrecht, Washington.
North Korea's parliament today re-elected Kim Jong-il as the isolated country's top leader. The parliament also approved his decision to keep and increase its nuclear deterrent force to counter what it calls a hostile U.S. policy. And it backed a previous statement that North Korea is no longer interested in multinational talks about its nuclear program. The parliament is considered no more than a rubber stamp body. The former minister convicted of gunning down an abortion doctor will be the first person in the U.S. to be executed for anti-abortion violence. Barring any unlikely last-minute stay, 49-year-old Paul Hill will be put to death tonight by lethal injection for the 1994 murders in Pensacola of Dr. John Britton and retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel James Herman Barrett. On Wall Street, stocks are generally up, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 40 points.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Treasury Secretary John Snow completed 2 days of meetings with top officials in Beijing today, saying he won assurances China will eventually allow its currency to trade freely on world markets. American jobs are lost, some say, because the value of the Chinese currency, the yuan, is kept artificially low. Well, to explore this, we're joined on the line now from Shanghai by Andrew Rothman. He's a China strategist for CLSA Asia Pacific. And welcome, Andy.
Hi.
Andy, first, how is the value of Chinese currency established now?
Well, for almost a decade now, the Chinese currency has been pegged to the U.S. dollar at about 8.3 yuan to the dollar.
And they just keep it that way, irregardless of how things change geopolitically.
That's right. It's not unusual for countries to peg their currency like this to the dollar when they're in a period of economic uncertainty and instability. It kind of gives them an opportunity to keep a level playing field for a period of time. And now, the Chinese have held this peg for that decade, even during times when it was not to their advantage.
Well, why would pegging their money to the dollar cost U.S. jobs?
Well, I think that that's probably a mistaken analysis. It's difficult to prove that the pegged rate cost U.S. jobs. And in fact, when John Snow's predecessors, Summers and Rubin, came to China over the last several years, they actually thanked the Chinese for maintaining the peg and asked them not to consider moving it, because at that time there were fears that China's currency would be devalued and that that would cost American jobs.
So why would John Snow come away from 2 days of meetings with the Chinese and then announce that he was apparently pleased that they were moving toward letting their currency trade freely on world markets?
Well, to understand this issue, it's probably helpful to divide it into two parts. One is the economics, and the other is the politics. On the economic side, I think that Snow and the rest of the Bush administration accept the fact that the peg is not contributing significantly to American job loss. But on the political side, we have a situation in the United States where you've got what some people call a jobless recovery, and the largest trade deficit that the United States has is with China. So it's fairly easy to blame imports from China. But I think it doesn't hold up to scrutiny, because for the first point, only about 3% of manufactured goods sold in the United States come from China. So even if you were to completely shut out those goods, it wouldn't have a dramatic impact on American employment. And the second point, I think, is that even if you stopped all Chinese imports, a company like Walmart, which last year bought about $12 billion worth of goods from China, is not going to all of a sudden start sourcing microwaves and laptops and socks from the United States. They're going to turn to another low-cost producer overseas.
Uh-huh. So where is this coming from? Is this democratic political pressure reaching the White House?
Well, I think it's coming from a couple of places. First of all, it's coming from people who genuinely believe, that they have lost their jobs because of unfair Chinese competition. And you have to say that there are some firms, particularly smaller and medium-sized manufacturers in the United States, in areas in particular like textiles and furniture, who aren't competitive anymore and see all these goods from China coming in, and they're trying to rationalize in their own mind why things have gone badly. Then I think you've got people in Congress who have always been opposed to free trade and who have grabbed onto this issue because the size of the deficit with China was $100 billion last year.
So, Andy, where is this all going?
Well, the Bush administration is going to put the best face it can on what the Chinese gave them. And what the Chinese gave them is the same thing they've been saying for several years now, which is the Chinese government recognizes that it's in its own interest to let the currency float, but they want to wait until the right time to start that process. And now is not the right time because their banking system is in a mess, and they've got probably 8% urban unemployment, and they don't want to take a risk on the economy right now. So I think there's pretty close to zero chance that we're going to see any change in the value of the currency in China this year. But again, as I said, I think the main point is that even if they were to raise the value of their currency, it's unlikely to create manufacturing jobs, and in fact could cost some Americans their jobs, because let's say Boeing, which ships a lot of aircraft to China, the price of their planes would go up by the amount that the currency appreciates, making it possible that they would be less competitive with Airbus.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andy Rothman, thanks very much for illuminating some of this for us.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Andrew Rothman is a China strategist for CLSA Asia Pacific. He joined us from Shanghai, China.
Well, as John Snow was pressuring China over its economic policy, there was good and bad economic news here at home. Numbers from the Institute of Supply Management, an industry group, showed that activity in the U.S. manufacturing sector was up again in August, the second consecutive monthly increase. Productivity is also up, and that means fewer workers producing more goods. But the bad news is there are far fewer workers. U.S. manufacturers have shed 2 million employees since July 2000, and they're still cutting. We're joined now by Richard DeKayser, chief economist with the National City Bank in Cleveland. And, Richard, first of all, what's driving this increase in domestic manufacturing?
Well, without a doubt, it's simply the increase we've seen in demand for goods by consumers, businesses, and government is what's driving the rebound in manufacturing.
So if there's a demand, why isn't there an increase in jobs?
Well, the reason is that productivity growth has generally been strong for the U.S. economy. It has been even stronger for the manufacturing sector. So it really requires a sustained period of strong demand and considerably stronger demand for jobs to be created. But aside from the manufacturing sector, we've seen things generally on the mend. help wanted advertising has picked up. Layoffs have declined pretty dramatically since the war's end. And we're even seeing over the past 3 months massive hiring of temporary workers. And after a few months of that, you tend to see them hiring more broadly through the economy.
Why would there be job recovery? In other words, why would a company that can get lower wage workers overseas create jobs here?
The real important question, in my opinion, is not are we losing jobs and business to foreign countries, including China, but are we creating other jobs in other industries to offset those losses? So while I'll concede the point that many firms, especially throughout the industrial Midwest, are taking that precise route, there are other areas of the economy, and I'll just rattle off a few: financial services, entertainment, biotechnology, and areas of the information technologies industries, including manufacturing industries, that are continuing to have very good growth prospects and don't find the low-cost environment to be in their greatest interest.
But if you are somebody who does widgets on an assembly line, you can't then suddenly become an entertainer. So it's a shift in the kinds of jobs, you're saying.
That's absolutely right. And I'm not at all arguing that there aren't going to be painful dislocations, because they're not the same people. Unfortunately, the process does have its frictions and does have its dislocations and does take time. But again, if we take a larger view, the U.S. economy has done an excellent job of offsetting these losses with gains elsewhere. And generally, those jobs lost have had lower, not higher wages than the jobs gained through foreign trade.
Richard, thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Richard DeKayser, chief economist with the National City Bank in Cleveland, Ohio.
Still to come, resident chef Kathy Gunst helps us with the transition from summer to autumn by cooking a comforting soup.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It can be hard enough to get concert tickets these days, with scalpers scooping up the best seats and reselling them at usually god-awful prices. Now, Ticketmaster, the sports and entertainment ticket vendor, is getting into the game. They're starting to offer premium seats for auction on their website, allowing the highest bidder to determine the price of the tickets. They recently auctioned seats to the Lennox Lewis Vitali Klitschko boxing match, and the best seats went for $7,000 apiece. The idea has some concern that front row seats will now, once and for all, belong to the richest fans, not necessarily the biggest fans. Well, joining us on the line now from Fresno, California, is Gary Bongiovanni. He's editor of Pollstar, a music industry trade magazine. Welcome, Gary.
My pleasure.
How much of this has to do with the simple reality that tickets are bought up by scalpers and are very quickly available on the Internet and elsewhere for hundreds and hundreds of dollars above often what they would have cost if you bought them at a ticket booth?
That was a large part of what really prompted the change in the pricing model, was because although the artists might have been charging $30 or $40 for tickets, they knew for years that if you went and talked to the people who were sitting down in front of the stage in those great seats, many of them had bought them from brokers at, you know, four, five, six times the price that the artist was getting paid on. And nobody except the ticket broker was making any of that extra money. None of it was going to the artist. None of it was going to the promoter or the building. So the realization was that the public had deemed that the real market value of these tickets was much higher than the artists were charging.
Yeah. Does this mean, though, that ticket prices will likely, in general, go up if sort of the top end is pulling everything else up?
I think under an auction situation, you will see the best seats going for whatever the market will bear. An ideal marketplace would also mean that those less desirable seats are going to sell for considerably less than perhaps what would have been face value under normal circumstances.
Uh-huh.
So your objective is to fill every seat and maximize the amount of revenue you can get.
How will this affect scalpers?
I don't know how active scalpers will be in trying to buy tickets, because by the time they get bid up, most of the margin that they would profit on is going to disappear. There are a lot of fans that participate in feeding these brokers. If there's a six or an eight ticket limit on a hot show and you work hard and you manage to get to the front of the queue, whether it's by phone or by internet, and buy six or eight tickets and you want two yourself, well, you can sell the other four for enough money to get your seats for free. There's a lot of that kind of thing going on, and that's not even really organized.
The reality of sort of what seems maybe ridiculously the romantic notion of, you know, staying up all night with a sleeping bag outside Madison Square Garden to see the Stones for a night or two. Those days are over anyway, huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're really determined to get tickets, I mean, you're standing in line with a cell phone and a computer with a Wi-Fi adapter, trying to buy them on the internet by phone and online, because there's only so many really good seats anyway, and the people who fight the hardest for them are going to be the ones to get them. If you don't do that, then it's a matter of how much money you can afford to buy it.
Gary Bongiovanni, thanks a lot for joining us on this one.
Thank you.
Gary Bongiovanni is editor of Polestar, a music industry trade magazine. He joined us from Fresno, California.
Well, I sincerely miss those heavy metal bands I used to go see on the landing in the summer. She fell in love with the drummer. She fell in love with the drummer. She fell in love.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Shiny, shiny pants and bleached blonde hair. A double kick.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now, and Bill and I have moved into the Here and Now kitchen to meet with our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, who's behind the stove with a huge pot of soup because we are entering soup season, also referred to as fall.
Yeah, sad as it is, summer is slowly fading on us. Except we're at that funny time of year where it can still be very, very warm and humid, and you don't really want anything hot. And then it can be so chilly at night, but you really start to crave those warmer foods. So I thought today we would make something.
I suppose you're in some sensible place like Arizona or
there
something.
There you go,
where these
right.
Don't
where
happen.
They don't have to deal with these seasons that are
actually
so tumultuous.
Can I just say, I was just out west, and it was pretty chilly at night. So there you go.
So this is an ideal soup wherever you are because it can be served cold or hot, and it actually has two different names. When it's hot, it's potato and leek soup.
Uh-huh.
Potatoes and leek both being vegetables that are harvested right now at this time of year. They are very, very fresh. Everybody's digging them out of their gardens. You'll find them in farmers markets, and this is the time to take advantage of them.
And when it's cold?
When it's cold. No, that's when it's hot. It's called when it's cold.
Oh, okay.
You have it. Now you got me confused. When it's cold, you eat it hot. When it's hot, it's called vichyssoise, which you've heard of, which, according to Miss Julia Child, is an American invention, actually, the name vichyssoise. So I want to just tell you a little bit about a leek.
Yeah,
it's the beginning of a joke.
What's a leek?
First, you take a leek. Here
out.
We have about an 8-inch vegetable.
And can we just
it's
say
enormous. If, I thought it was if, a little thing, a leek.
No, no.
We have to say, if you have an 8-year-old in the car, they're already laughing their head
that's
off.
That's right. Because it's the beginning of every joke. So I will say it. First, you take a leek.
There you go.
We got that over. With.
Right.
Okay. It is a large vegetable. It is in the onion family. The base of it is white, you will notice, and the top is green. What's prized about it is the white section.
A torch.
A green torch. There you go. It's very different than onions and garlic because they're eaten fresh. You don't dry them out. And this white part is achieved because farmers, I've grown them myself, you mound dirt over and over. You put them in kind of a trough and you just keep mounding dirt over them so no photosynthesis occurs and it stays white. And this is the prized part of the vegetable. Hmm. So what you're going to do is you're going to cut off the stem end.
Okay, that's the big white part. It's about 4 inches long.
Right, but then we are only going to keep the white part. Now, I know this looks criminal to be throwing away all this green, but don't. Save it and make a beautiful vegetable stock. This is really full of flavor, but we don't want it in our vichyssoise or our potato and leek soup because we want it to be white. We don't want the green.
And that's about 10 inches of big green.
Yeah, which is going to make a beautiful vegetable stock. You throw it in a pan with onion, celery, peppercorn, salt. salt, let it simmer for an hour, and use that as the base of the soup.
But for the soup, you're just taking a really small
segment. I'm going to take it here. I'm going to just cut off a little bit of the root. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you can use a tiny bit of the pale green. But here's the thing about leeks. Because they're grown in so much dirt, they have layers. And each one of those layers, as it grows, traps the dirt. So here's my trick. This is something people are scared of, to use leeks, because they don't know how to clean them. Inside, you'll see this, there are all these little layers.
You just split it right
in half. I split it in half lengthwise, and I'm going to slosh it around in some water here. You want to make sure you get all the dirt out, because it hides. And there's nothing worse than soup with dirt in it. So here I am. I'm cutting it lengthwise. I'm peeking. These
are
fairly
layers,
clean.
And it always looks like loose leaf paper.
It's very, very beautiful to cut open a leek and see it. And you'll see some of the dirt is hiding in there. So once you clean it, you're going to just simply chop it. And I'm going to use about 3 or 4 leeks here. And I've gotten some started here. This is called sweating. Hot. Sweating the leeks. I have them in a little bit of olive oil, thinly sliced.
Now they look like celery or
something. Yeah, they do kind of, but they have a gorgeous aroma. What is so wonderful about leeks is that they have a natural sweetness. They're one of the few root vegetables. Well, that's not true. Many root vegetables survive the frost, and people do keep them in their gardens past this time of year into Thanksgiving because they can take a frost, and some people actually believe they get sweeter. So we're going to sweat the leeks, otherwise known as cooking them with the lid on. And we're going to do that for about 10 minutes. And then we have our other ingredient. Leek and potato soup is such a humble soup. You're taking really humble ingredients, the potato and the leek, and you're transforming it into a fairly sophisticated soup that's so full of flavor. A little bit of salt and pepper with our leeks. And to spice it up just a bit, I've got some fresh chives here that I've chopped up. I'm going to add just a small teaspoon of that and some fresh thyme.
I think you have to do that because you're talking about two basically white vegetables. They're a little bland.
But you know what's interesting is that this is supposed to be a white soup. And usually white food means boring food. But in this case, I think you'll be really surprised to see. So that's going to go for about 10 minutes. Then we've got a potato. If you want to make this a low-fat soup and not add heavy cream, you want to use a creamy potato. Now, there really is such a thing. I have a Yukon Gold here, and I'm just going to peel it and chop it into 2-inch pieces. A creamy potato or a medium starch potato, a potato that will hold up to long cooking, and if you use a creamy variety, you'll find that your soup is naturally creamy.
So as opposed to what?
As opposed to just a plain old white Idaho potato,
Idaho,
adds a wonderful texture. The whole soup's going to get pureed. Okay, I'm just going to chop my potato up.
Yep.
So we've got our leeks. We've got about 4 leeks and about 4 potatoes here. And we'll put them in here. It is an interesting concept.
Yeah, creamy potatoes.
Not only does potatoes thicken a soup, but they can add a creamy consistency.
Just ask your grocer which the creamier ones are.
Well, absolutely, but I would really recommend a Yukon Gold.
Okay.
It's very available. So now I'm sneaking here. I have a pot that's all ready.
Yes, we're not going to be going into All Things Considered
with this recipe.
No, we're not faking it. It's for real, but it's done. Now, this is the leeks and the potatoes that have simmered for 10 minutes with 4 cups of chicken broth. Mm. Also, you can make this a completely vegetarian soup by adding that vegetable stock I talked about that you could make out of the leek greens, or you could buy vegetable stock. And you can use canned vegetable stock. You can use homemade. This is a pretty quick recipe.
Going right to the blender.
Right to the blender. You could use a food processor ready for some noise.
Okay. Or not.
What's wrong with it?
It's perhaps not
I've unplugged
in.
My blender.
You see
another blackout.
It's a little trick, you know, called electricity, okay?
You're going to do this the way a lot of soups are done. You're going to take a bit by bit and pulverize it in the blender.
Exactly. Maybe we won't get our blender going today.
Okay.
Well, fine. But we know the sounds that sounds like.
The sound of the blender.
Okay.
The
theoretical blender.
That's right. I know what we did. We turned that off. So you're going to blend it in the blender. So you've got leeks, potatoes, chicken soups, blend it up. And then this is what it looks like. And what you're going to do is you're going to add a tiny bit of cream if you would like. Now, would you like to try it hot or cold? Because it is fascinating to see what a temperature difference can do to the same flavors.
So you don't have to add the cream.
You do not. As I said, that potato will thicken it and give it a creamy texture. Here's a hot soup. I'd like to garnish it with a little bit of chives.
Right.
And while you're tasting, I'm going to see if my blender will get going here. Here's a hot one, and there's a cold one, Bill.
Okay.
You should both try both of them, because it's really interesting.
So
all you have are potatoes and leeks and broth and chives, but they taste completely different.
So I'm tasting the hot
Potato and leek soup.
And Bill's tasting
vichyssoise.
I guess that's your vichyssoise. It's very creamy.
Isn't that creamy?
And cold.
And really refreshing on a warm day, which we will still have a lot of.
So funny, Robin.
That's all I'm not even saying. And so what's a leek? Do you think you can taste it?
Well, I know now. That's the great thing about this.
But, you know, it's really quite different than a regular onion. There's a subtlety to it. It doesn't scream onion. It doesn't make you
cry. Subtleties of the leek, yeah.
The subtleties of a leek. Is that the title of your new autobiography?
That's the title of your next cookbook.
Okay. Now try the different one. I really want you guys to see. Temperature is a fascinating thing in food.
It's very
hot. Completely change the flavors.
Oh, yeah, it really does.
Isn't that?
It's sort of sharper.
And I don't know. Some people just love it cold, and they can never want to have it hot. But we are getting into that time of year where leeks have this whole interesting history, too. They used to be called the asparagus of the poor. And Romans used to drink leek juice to strengthen their voices, which is a good radio tip for you guys.
There you go.
There you go, Bill. First, you didn't know what a leek is. Now you're going to be drinking
sort of
it.
Like enormous green torch plant.
That's it.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much, hot or cold.
And sorry about our power outage with the blender.
That's all right. That's been happening a lot lately.
Yes, since we're going around. We're so trendy.
Blame it on Ohio.
Oh, no.
We're going to retire and have our soup both hot and cold. If you want to know more about Kathy's recipe, by all means, check out our website, here-now.org. Pictures and directions. For hot or cold. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Here Now's resident chef and cookbook author, Kathy Gunst. And again, for her recipe, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is scheduled to sum up his first 100 days in office.
Also, actress and UNICEF ambassador Jessica Lange talks about the systematic use of rape in the Congo.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.